Hi, welcome to Visual Studio Toolbox. I'm your host, Robert Green, and my special guest today is Rocky Lotka. Rocky, how are you?
Hi, good to see you again.
For those of you who don't know Rocky, Rocky is a world-famous trainer, speaker, author, consultant for Magenic Technologies, leading light in the .NET space. If there was a Hall of Fame, you'd be in it. I could go on, but I'm probably done here.
That's probably for the best.
So that's Rocky. Rocky is in town for VS Live, which is on the Redmond campus this week. And that's great because I emailed Rocky and said, how'd you like to be on the show? And Rocky said, sure.
Absolutely.
So welcome.
Thank you.
To the Toolbox.
Should be a lot of fun.
And you're going to show us today CSLA.
Yes, that's right.
Which is a framework, an enterprise caliber framework for .NET applications.
Yep, it's something that's been around in one form or another for, well, since 1996, I think.
Okay.
In a COM version, and then later a .NET version, and now working on a WinRT version, so it gets
sweet.
More and more fun all the time.
So tell me why I should use a framework. I mean, I know you know, but for people that don't know why they should use a framework, why should you use a product such as CSLA? Why should you use a framework? How do you choose among the various frameworks out there? And how do you then, of course, land on CSLA and decide that that's the one to use?
Well, I think I'm an advocate of frameworks in general. It probably goes without saying since I create one and maintain it. But to me, the value of a framework comes out of the underlying architecture or philosophy that the author has.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that get all excited about MVVM or dependency injection or MVC or different patterns or concepts, and they get so passionate around them that they think, well, everybody should use this, and maybe not everybody, but it's valuable to a lot of people. And what turns out is that a lot of these concepts and patterns are harder to do in practice than they seem on paper.
Name one that wasn't.
And,
they're always harder.
They're always harder.
They're easy to get started in general, but yes.
And at least at the level we're talking about, I think that frameworks, at least the best ones, grow out of some base concept or vision or philosophy, whatever term you want to use.
Mm-hmm.
That the author has about how some aspect of software should be done. And they get this idea, maybe they write it on, like in my case, I started out writing books and then later got into the framework game. Other people skip the book part, which may be saner. I don't know.
Probably these days.
But ultimately, a framework is a way of supporting the architectural concepts. That's the way I look at it.
Okay.
And so where things would be possible but hard, hopefully the framework makes them much easier or more approachable. At a minimum, it should make it so that you're doing things in a repeatable, consistent fashion.
So is it safe to say that a framework is basically plumbing? It's somebody else, presumably somebody way smarter than you, has written a bunch of plumbing that you don't have to write yourself.
As a general rule, yeah, that's
okay,
right.
So the entity framework is a framework. And it's the plumbing to work with data, the low-level plumbing that you don't have to write. You just have to learn how to use that framework. And then there's a whole bunch of underlying code that you don't have to write.
Yes. Yep.
So CSLA is essentially in that category. Is that correct?
Yep. That's right. Okay. I think that there's lots of different kinds of frameworks. But when you look at building an application, you probably need some sort of UI framework, an MVC or MVVM or MVP.
Are those frameworks or are those patterns?
Well, those are patterns.
Okay.
But as a general rule, if you just were to set out and say, wow, I'm in love with MVP, and I'm going to go do this model view presenter thing from scratch, you could spend months writing a decent MVP platform on which to build your actual application. Most people aren't getting paid to write frameworks. They're getting paid to write business applications.
Right.
And although a lot of us over the years have probably conned our employers into letting us write framework bits, really, if you look at it objectively, you'd be better off going out and using Prism or ASP.NET MVC or Calibre Micro or you know, MVVM Lite or one of these, mm-hmm. there's many of these frameworks at a UI level that take those patterns and make them approachable.
Right.
And then, like you said, there's Entity Framework, nHibernate, and a variety of what LLBL Gen. There's a bunch of other frameworks mm-hmm. at the data level that kind of do the same thing for talking to databases. And CSLA is a little unique in that it sits in between those two. It's not a UI framework or a data framework. It's focused entirely on business logic okay. and how to create things. And basically, how do you wrap up all your validation, business rules, calculations, mm-hmm. all, you know, authorization, all those things into a maintainable place.
Hmm. So how do you evaluate frameworks? How do you, is it easy to learn what they do, how they're written? You said it's the author's philosophy. Can you glean the author's philosophy from looking at a framework and decide, oh yes, I want to code like that, or do you just say, well, this thing works and I don't have to do any of this stuff and I can figure out how to use it, so go.
Yet again, easier said than done. What most people do is construct some sort of checklist, like a feature list, and then they go down the various frameworks and read the web, read documentation, mm-hmm. and attempt to put check boxes or X's in you know, yeses or no's or maybes in all of the different grids. And then but I think that misses the point. And I actually mm-hmm. think, although you might succeed doing that, I think it's actually dangerous because you might find a framework or two that pretty closely match your feature list, but they might have diametrically opposite philosophies on how software should be designed.
Right.
And you may or may not agree with one or, well, maybe either of the philosophies, but if you pick a framework because it has your features, but it supports some concepts that you disagree with, you're going to fight with it constantly.
Right.
And as opposed to if you pick a framework where you generally agree with the author's philosophy and the way they think about building software, you're going to find your life is simplified mm-hmm. and you're going to work with the framework instead of against it. Sadly, that's hard to figure out. I mean, right. you know, without actually sitting down and using the framework or reading a lot of web content, or if you're lucky enough that the people have written either substantial documentation or books, or mm-hmm. you know, there's different ways this can be done, but in the end you have to, you know, read and absorb a lot of information, or possibly go to conferences, and you know, I mean, that's one of the advantages of things like VS Live or TechEd or places where people that write these frameworks yeah. tend to speak. You can go up after a talk and say, right. "Hey, so, you know, how yep. do you think about software?" You know?
Right.
But not everybody can do that, obviously.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So, tell us a bit about CSLA. So, what we want to do here is kind of give an overview for the viewers who may be new to it, and then quickly get into some of its benefits, and then you're going to talk about some of the new features,
mm-hmm.
right?
Absolutely.
All right.
So CSLA, just building software, and my background, which is largely building line of business systems that have user interfaces for you know, line of business people, so people working in shipping and manufacturing and, mm-hmm. and driving trucks and, you know, whatever else. Not necessarily super tech-savvy people. For whatever reason, I've written a lot of systems like that. So optimized keystrokes, performance, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about building software for line of business, one of your primary areas of focus, I think, should be on how cost-effective is it to keep the system running over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Working in consulting, of course, we always end up talking to our customers about how much is this going to cost to build.
Right.
Because that's the upfront cost, and it's easy to relatively easy to quantify, and of course, it's a lump sum. And what people, I think, often maybe forget or don't fully appreciate is you might spend $500,000 building a piece of software, or $1 million, or, you know, whatever it might be, but then if you're going to run it for 5 or 10 years, you're going to continually maintain it, enhance it, tweak it, It'll over a 10-year period, it'll certainly change platforms at least once. Mm-hmm. And so that cost of maintenance will completely overwhelm that upfront cost. And so having a framework, having consistency in your coding and your architecture increases your maintainability and reduces your cost.
Right.
So that's a big driver for a CSLA.
Okay.
And then another piece of CSLA is built-in support for growth, which the story that I like to tell is, and I think this resonates with a lot of people, is where you write this little application and your end users told you it was just a stopgap app for like five people, and we're replacing system A with system B, and we just need this thing in the interim. And then maybe, you know, 18 or 24 months later, you get this panicked call because it's now behind the scenes, unknown to you. Mm-hmm. You're a victim of your own success.
Right. It's now mission critical.
It's now mission critical, used by 50 people in, you know, five different offices, and it's down.
Right.
What happened? And CSLA specifically attempts to help address that by allowing you purely through configuration to switch from one tier, two tier, three tier to a four tier physical deployment. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that you could write your application for five users, maybe it's a two tier deployment, and when they call in a panic 2 years later, you can just stand up an app server, switch some configuration, and all of a sudden you're three tier, and it scales and runs reliably. And you had almost no work. Now you can make it sound really hard.
Of course.
Right.
Of course. Uh-huh.
And then the final big point is to abstract .NET. And I love .NET. I'm not trying to get rid of it. But if you look at the history of .NET, we all embraced remoting for a few years, and then it was replaced by WCF. And now WCF may or may not be replaced by Web API, but that certainly seems to be, you know, the trendy technology. Mm-hmm. And then on the UI side, we had Windows Forms and Web Forms, and then Web Forms 2 and Windows Forms 2 and WPF and Silverlight, and now WinRT.
Yep.
And so there's a lot of change that occurs outside of our control. And none of those changes impact our business. Right? I mean, they might give the user a better experience or make more scalable or secure systems.
Right.
But my actual business processes are essentially unaffected by the fact that I'm now using XAML instead of HTML.
Yep, definitely true.
And so the objective in CSLA's viewpoint is, why should I have to rewrite all my business logic just because I switched to a different kind of presentation technology, for example? Now, CSLA has been around in one form or another, like I said, since probably 1996.
Yep.
And originally it was COM and VB, and now in the last decade, of course, it's all been .NET, and these days it's all C#, although VB and anybody can use it, but it's written in C#. And it supports .NET and Silverlight. I've branched out a little into the non-Microsoft world because it supports Android through the use of Mono for Android, and Linux and Mac through Mono. And now what I'm currently working on is support for .NET 4.5, which is very cool, and WinRT on Windows 8, which is similarly very, very cool. So that's a lot of the changes over the years have been driven by the addition of generics in 2005 or the addition of the Entity Framework or things like that. From a more technical perspective, the framework offers just a, and this is, ends up kind of that feature checkbox thing, right? But I wrote it originally because I wanted to have this ability to switch between two and three tier deployments with just through configuration, and because I wanted to have objects that could move between the application server and the client back and forth. And if you want to get really geeky, I wanted them to bounce off satellites, right? Because if you just write a normal two-tier app, right, where your client talks to your database, you're probably just going over your network or whatever else. But as soon as you get into this three- and four-tier deployment world, it's not unrealistic to think that somebody's going to build a client application that's going to be used, let's say, in China against a data center in London. And the odds of your data, your objects, your communication bouncing off a satellite or something like that are pretty high.
Sure.
And that's just cool. Right? I mean, in a geeky way, but,
right.
You know, I mean, most of us will never, I don't think I'll ever get into space, but at least my code has, so I feel good.
You might win the lottery. You can buy your way into space. Yeah, it's kind of pricey. Maybe the cost comes down, who knows?
Yeah, what is it, $5 million or something now? But what most people use the framework for is that it supports data binding across all of the UI technologies. And that's a tall order. I mean, interestingly enough, it's not a problem I set out to solve. It's one I kind of fell into. I made it work in Windows Forms, and then Web Forms is data binding works different.
Right.
And then WPF is slightly different yet, and Silverlight is slightly different. And if you want to, if your stated goal, which is mine, is to say I've got a set of business logic or objects, and I want to be able to bind them to Windows Forms or Silverlight or WinRT, and have them always work without me having to change my business code, that's where the magic comes in from the framework perspective.
It
hides all that stuff. And a lot of the other points are around supporting validation rules, business rules, authorization rules, and being able to interact with different kinds of data access technology. It's similar to how CSLA abstracts the idea of talking to different UI layer or technologies. I try to abstract the idea of talking to the entity framework versus raw ADO.NET or data sets, or I don't feel like I should dictate to you how you talk to your database. My focus is on the business logic. And then probably the final, and this is almost like a marketing graphic in a sense, but I've been doing this for a long, long, long time. And the upside to that is that it's had time to grow and get used in a lot of interesting places. Mm-hmm. And so it's used by thousands of people, organizations around the world. Some of them are corporate entities, and some of them are local state governments or military organizations or NGOs, all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And in that regard, it's both exhilarating because I get emails from people, and I'm like, wow, really? That's so cool. And then it's also extremely humbling because you're like, at least I look at it and I'm like, people, I'm just writing this little framework that hopefully does some cool stuff, but there are people out there using it to build software that makes, decisions that end up in the news or, and it's just kind of, that's kind of cool to think of what people are able to do and choose to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
all right, let's see it.
Absolutely. Get rid of PowerPoint here, maybe. So, at least to start with, I'll just create a new project.
Okay.
And if you're using Visual Studio 2010 and .NET 4 or 3.5, CSLA is available through NuGet, and so it's pretty easy to get it. I'm going to go out on a limb here and try using Visual Studio 2012 and the in-process or in-progress CSLA 4.5 code that literally is being worked on as we speak. So hopefully it'll work. And it's not in NuGet, so we'll just add direct file references. But to start with, maybe we'll just create a simple WPF application and give it a fancy name. And, of course, this is just a simple WPF app, and because CSLA supports this concept of multiple tier deployments, as a general rule, what you'll want to do is put all of your business logic in a separate assembly. So we'll add a new project and create a class library here. Just call it library because that's imaginative. And we'll add a reference to the CSLA assemblies. And I'm just going to grab one of my more recent ones here. And you can, if you look closely at the screen, you can probably see that I've got CSLA from Silverlight .NET 4, .NET 4.5, which is what I want right now, and other platforms. So I have it targeted all mm-hmm. these different platforms. So once I've got CSLA referenced, then maybe we can rename this to Person Edit or something along that line. Make that a little bit bigger. At a minimum, you generally want to use the CSLA namespace because that's where all the goodies come from. But CSLA serialization is necessary for Silverlight and WinRT because we had to fill in some gaps in serialization concepts that mm-hmm. existed in .NET that don't exist in these newer platforms. And CSLA classes are always serializable because, I didn't talk about this explicitly, but the idea is that these objects literally do move between your client right. and application server. And then CSLA is, generally speaking, an inheritance-based framework. And so there's a set of six base classes that you generally inherit from in order to create a business class. Mm-hmm. And so business base is a base class that lets you create an editable object that has rules and so forth. There's also, for example, read-only base that the only kinds of rules it supports are read-only authorization.
Okay.
Because what else would you do in a read-only object? Right. And then I'm a fan of snippets. This has got to be one of the best features ever added to Visual Studio.
Me too.
And so I've got a set of snippets that...
Yeah, that makes two of us.
Come with CSLA. And so I can just quickly...
What do you use to create snippets?
a text editor. I know there are better tools out there, but... I've got maybe there's 20 or something as part of CSLA, and that's for the most part what I have got.
So you just typed XML by hand?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, I open them up actually in Visual Studio.
I use the snippet editor, the one Bill MacArthur wrote.
Oh,
I still use that.
Yep. Well, I did use that at one point and enjoyed it, and then kind of I lost it in some upgrade and never... Yeah.
Well, it's free. I can send it to you.
Yeah, what you gonna do? So here's some basic properties, and one of the things about I think any framework is it should loan consistency to what you're doing, and so all the properties in CSLA tend to look the same. And if you're familiar with WPF or Windows Workflow dependency properties, mm-hmm. these look extremely similar. So there's a static field that gives you metadata about the property. And there's a variety of reasons for that. The two big ones are that now I've got a strongly typed token for describing this property.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't have to use the property name in quotes, which increases maintainability. And then secondly, in Silverlight and WinRT, there are restrictions on reflection. And although they seem to have loosened recently in Silverlight 5, which is very exciting. But nonetheless, this avoids those restrictions because I'm able to have my framework do a lot of things without using reflection because I've got this strongly typed token.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got a couple helper methods like getProperty that returns the property value, but it does it only if the user's allowed. So it checks rules first. And similarly, set property is even more sophisticated, so it makes sure you're allowed to change the property. And then if you are, then it makes sure the property is different from, or the new value is different from the old value. And if it's different, then it accepts the new value, then it runs all your business rules,
okay.
and it updates data binding. So set property, that one line of code replaces what is used to be about 16 lines on a typical property. So. It's a pretty nice deal. And so at this point, we've got an object that is bindable across all the UIs. And the challenging thing with a framework like CSLA is it's a code-based framework, right? So you only get so sexy. But some things that are worth noting, and not a lot of people know about this, but there are some attributes, and I suppose I have to add go down here and find system.componentModel.dataAnnotations. And if we add a reference to the data annotations assembly, then we can say I'd like to add a using for data annotations. And I get access to a set of, let's see, person name, a set of attributes.
So those attributes are defined by CSLA?
No, these are defined by Microsoft.
Ah, okay.
These come out of the componentModel.dataAnnotations namespace. And this required is actually a validation rule.
Right.
And, of course, you can have range and put in, of course, for the string, maybe not so much, but what else? String required, I think, or string length, there we go. Maybe this has a max length of 50. And these were originally created for WCF data services and then found their way into ASP MVC and into Silverlight. But CSLA actually embraces them. And so CSLA has got its own rules engine, but it picks up on these. And so these actually will work, because we're inside a CSLA object, these attributes will work in Windows Forms, WPF, WinRT, Windows Phone, even Android. So we made basically even platforms that have never heard of this concept, it works. And so that's kind of a nice deal. And then we probably want to add some sort of basic persistence. And again, I've got a snippet. I'm a fan of the factory pattern. So if I fill in this snippet just a little bit. So what I've done here is created a set of methods that basically describe how to create a new person edit or get an existing person edit. And at this point in time, CSLA supports the new async await pattern, but it also supports the Silverlight callback pattern. So it's a call, but then there's a event-driven, here I'm done type model. I thought about taking that out, but I'm leaving it in for backward compatibility.
Okay, so you can call one or the other. You can use both.
And then if you're in .NET, you can use a synchronous call.
Okay.
Which less and less, I think, is applicable. Right? Even if you're writing Windows Forms, there's tremendous value in creating or doing these calls asynchronously.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because these might be calling, bouncing off satellites, and you don't know. This could take a while. And then the other thing that we'll do is, and I mentioned earlier how CSLA is very neutral on how you talk to databases, and it's actually got a pretty sophisticated abstraction layer for allowing you to talk to databases how you want and create your own data access layers how you want. The simplest model is one where we just create a method such as data portal fetch in the object itself, and then in here you would call your data access layer, whatever that may be. It's the entity framework or whatever you're going to do. Or a lot of people use dependency injection at this point and will actually dynamically load some data access layer based on configuration. In this case, because it's a demo, I'm going to be cheating kind of. And I'm just going to put a little bit of code right in here and say that the object's ID is equal to the ID and the object's name. Oops. Is equal to Robert Smith, something like that. So,
okay,
just making stuff up, right? So at this point, we should have an object that at least we can retrieve, and which has some, if we go up here, some basic rules around the name property.
Okay.
So if we return now to the WPF application, we'll add a reference to our library, and then of course we have to add a reference to the CSLA assembly because of the inheritance. So we'll find the right one here. And I'm a fan of MVVM and everything else too, but again, to do it from scratch, you only go so far without a framework, right? And so we'll just keep this simple. Make the font size a little bit bigger so we can see what we're doing. And maybe create a little stack panel here and text block.
So have you started training yourself to use the designer at this point instead of typing XAML? Or is that on your list of things to do?
You know, when WPF was first being introduced how many years ago,
yeah.
I was consistent in saying, boy, if I ever have to type XAML, this whole thing's a bust, right? If I don't have a Windows Forms-like designer.
Yeah.
And so I guess by that definition, it's a bust. You know, there wasn't a good designer for years, and so, you know, like a lot of people, I ended up learning XAML.
It's and really, really hard to break the habit.
Once you've learned how to type it, the designers are slow. Unless you're doing things like animations or there are things where the designer's a lot nicer, but it's a hard habit to break.
It is. I'm committed to breaking it, but it's very slow going.
Yeah, it is.
And the designer in 2012 is very, very cool.
I agree.
You know, I had Joanna Mason on a couple months ago, and she was building a Windows 8 XAML app using Blend, and she would do in 30 seconds what it would take me, you know, 20 minutes to do in XAML. And I said, oh, man. And there were a couple occasions where she actually did in 30 seconds what a week ago it had taken me, literally, you know, a dozen minutes to do. And I'm just sold. But
no,
sold on the concept, but so far the implementation is very slow.
And I'm not much of a UI guy to start with. I'm much more of a plumbing guy. So for me, it's maybe even a higher bar, in a sense, to, you know, learn that than it would be. A lot of my focus is to write about this much and then test different data binding combinations, and that's as far as I need to go. All right, and then let's see what else we're going to do. We'll just as the form loads, we'll go out and get that object. And so here we'll just, now this is where it gets fun, right? Because I can make this an async method. And then in here, I can say this.dataContext is equal to await library.personEdit.getPersonEdit. So that'll call that getPerson. What am I doing wrong here? Oh, how about getPersonEdit async? There's those three different overloads, right? So the getPersonEdit async method, if we go look at that, is going to call a CSLA concept or component called the data portal.
Mm-hmm.
This is what knows how to talk to your application server, whether it's a real server or not. In this case, at least right now, it won't be. And ultimately, what this will do is it's going to say, I'd like to fetch an object of type person edit, and here's the ID value.
Okay.
And that results in the CSLA framework creating an instance of your object and then calling this method so that you can populate it with data.
Cool.
And like I said, you know, this highlighted code here would probably call out to an abstract data access layer to get the data. So let's see if this builds. And now we'll see if it runs. And of course, it's very fast because it's all running right here. So that's exciting, right? Now, what makes this maybe more exciting is if we start looking at adding out things like an application server. So if I add a new project here and say I'd like to create an empty web application, we'll call it app server. here too via a couple of references to the application server, so it has code. And of course, you don't really have to add these references, right? They just have to be in the bin directory. But for developers, it's generally easiest to say, well, I'd like to use CSLA, and I'm going to make use of my business code on the server too. Now, this is the point at which I tend to cheat a little bit. And the reason I cheat is because web config files. I mean, really, who wants to remember all that stuff? And so I always, as far as I know, there's no snippets in config files, are there?
No.
Yeah, that would be nice. That'd be very exciting. So somewhere lurking in here is my WCF host config file. And the reason that I do what I'm doing, as you'll see in a second, is I want this whole system.service model configuration block, because this configures WCF, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'll copy that in here. Now on the upside, this whole configuration block basically is the same for every application out there, because it's not configuring your application, it's configuring the CSLA
right.
data portal. And so we can see that I'm creating, for instance, an endpoint that uses basic HTTP binding to support Silverlight, and then here's one that uses WSHTTP to support .NET clients.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the upside. And then the other thing that we need to add into the app server are two SVC files. And again, although these are not that hard to type, but again, I'll go grab them out of a pre-existing sample. Because although they aren't a lot of code, the reality is that I find these SVC files to be obscure. You know, for example, I guess they're not obscure. It's just you set up your service once and then you run it for years, and so you never actually look at this one little blurb of code, right? So that's at this point, I've now created my app server, and although that might have seemed like a little bit of drudgery, it was actually pretty simple, right? Because we create an empty web app, add two SVC files, some config, and then reference some assemblies.
Mm-hmm.
So then we just need to go to my sample application, the client app, and tell it that I would like to use some data portal proxy called csla.dataportalclient.wcfproxy. It's in the CSLA assembly. And then I would like to tell it what URL to use. Oops, I want to go there. And so to find the URL, what I'll generally do is view this guy in the browser, grab that URL, and then I can paste that in here. And if I did everything right, which is always, you never know. So now, of course, that took a little longer.
Well, that proves it's working, because you get the delay.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Awesome.
So, same behavior, just switched from one tier, two tier, to three, basically, however you want to look at it. Rather than subjecting us all to watching me write more XAML, I can switch to a pre-existing CSLA sample that I'm in the process of updating to CSLA 4.5. And so this has a little bit more to it, but the same basic structure. So I've got my business library project that has some... my video card's having a trouble here.
Well...
Let's zoom back out, and maybe I'll close Visual Studio and try that again. All right. How about if I don't zoom in this time?
Okay.
We'll try one more time. I just won't move the cursor. So you can see looking at this that there's a little more to it. The business library assembly is a normal .NET class library. Mm-hmm. And it has business classes just like we looked at. And then there's two copies of the business library, one that targets Silverlight and one that targets WinRT.
And how much of the code is duplicated then?
Well, it's all exactly the same code. What I use is a feature of Visual Studio called linking, or file linking.
Okay.
So the files exist only in the business library project, physically.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're linked into the other two projects. And the Patterns and Practices group used to have a tool, an add-in for Visual Studio, that would automate a lot of that linking. It was something that was part of, I think, part of Prism at one point. I don't know that that's been ported forward, but I hope that they do, because that was particularly useful.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a concept called portable class libraries.
That's where I was headed with that. Have you investigated using those?
Well, so the interesting thing with portable class libraries is that if you can write your code, in my case, so if I could write CSLA so that it had no differences, no compiler directive differences between platforms, then I could use it.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you have to have compiler directive differences, which sadly I do, then you would create satellite assemblies per platform.
Right.
And so then somebody to use CSLA would add a reference to CSLA.dll, which would be portable, and they would also have to add a reference to the platform-specific DLL for their platform. And it's not clear to me that you gain anything then. In fact, now you have to add two references instead of one.
Okay.
Whereas what I do is I have a version of CSLA-DLL that compiles for .NET, compiles for Windows Phone, for WinRT, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So the same thing is what I'm doing here. And I would love to use portable class libraries. And I think at some point that'll be possible.
Okay.
Right now, the Windows Phone is pretty radically different still.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Windows Phone 8 might help with that. And Silverlight is still too different from WinRT and from .NET 4.5 in order to use portable class libraries. So all three of these business library assemblies are the same assembly, the exact same code, just compiled for three different target platforms. And it's exactly what the portable class library should solve. In this case, I actually do have a data access project, which is an abstracted mock data access layer. And then the rest of these are an ASP MVC interface, a Silverlight interface project, Windows Forms, WPF, and WinRT, with the exception of WCF Host, which is my app server. And so if we look just at one of these classes, for example, this is similar to what I wrote by hand just moments ago. So it's serializable, it inherits from business space, it has some properties that basically look like we talked about. In fact, I'm even using some of the data annotations attributes. The one thing that is different is this is using a different kind of data access technique. So instead of putting the data access methods directly in the business class like I did before, here, all of the data access code is in this data access assembly.
Okay.
So it's got a better separation. And again, I think it's good to give people choices, so I allow for both of these. And then this one, because I use this for demos, has some custom business rules, which is probably a topic unto itself. So let's just... suffice it to say that you can create your own sophisticated business rules by inheriting from business rule and overriding the execute method. And inside of here, you can validate your data, manipulate your data, do calculations, whatever you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extremely flexible and powerful. And if I go down a little further, then these are the factory methods, which are extremely similar. And again, well, in fact, they're so similar because they just call the data portal and let it do its work. And if we look In fact, right now my default is a WinRT application. And so if we look inside of my references, you can see that I'm referencing CSLA, mm-hmm. and I'm also referencing my business library that's targeted or compiled for WinRT. And in my main page XAML. So if we look at the designer inside of this particular project for the main page, we can see that basically I've got the same kind of XAML as before, where I've set up some simple text blocks and then got a text box where I'm doing a binding.
Mm-hmm.
And basically I've got a set of those. In this case, I'm using one of the new WinRT controls, the list view,
mm-hmm.
Which I love. It has little animations and everything all by itself. One of the things when WPF came out and then Silverlight to some degree that I always thought is that there should have been some pre-built templates or pre-built styles and themes. Then they kind of came later,
yeah.
but they
mm-hmm.
were never really in the box, right? And as a Windows Forms developer, I could always drag and drop and create something that was maybe not aesthetically awesome, but it was professional.
Yeah.
And with WPF, everything just dragging and dropping was black and white.
Right.
You have to have a designer help you in order to get it to look professional. One of the things that I love about the Windows Phone and WinRT work is that the templates that you get out of the box,
yes.
are I feel good about the results, right? They're professional. It's great. So I'm using the list view anyway. Which is nice, lets me set up a nice header template and then an item template for mm-hmm. each item in a collection. And so if we run this application, and this is also set up to be three tiers, so it runs the application, goes across, gets the data, and we can see now that I've got my my data here and my list of products. My cancel and save buttons are disabled
mm-hmm.
because they're data bound. To the business object, and the business object understands that it hasn't been changed yet, so how could you save anything?
Okay.
And so if we add a change, now all of a sudden these buttons light up, and I can click cancel and it resets the data. And behind the cancel button is literally one line of code that tells the object graph to reset itself. That's one other feature of CSLA that comes out of the Windows Forms world, really, where cancel buttons are a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these days, most forms probably don't have cancel buttons anymore.
Right.
Who does that? But it's still kind of neat. I can click save now because it's been changed. So,
right.
And then that same application or the same concept, if we want to go look at a WPF interface. And this one's styled a little bit better. One of Magenic's people that actually has a little skill with design mm-hmm. kindly, he took pity on me. He's like, dude, how can you show demos like this? Well, help me. So he did. That was great. So again, the cancel and save
okay.
light up.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I don't think we need to walk through all of them, but they all basically you get the same behavior because all of these UIs are just a thin layer on mm-hmm. top of this common business DLL that's doing all of
right.
the real work for us.
So does the WinRT business library would work on XAML as well as JavaScript apps, right? It's completely UI independent?
No, this is definitely .NET.
Win8 apps built with JavaScript?
No.
Nope. Ah, okay.
Nope. Because I'm referencing in this client. Whoops, wrong project. Apologize. But in this WinRT client, I'm referencing CSLA, CSLA
okay.
XAML,
mm-hmm.
which are essentially .NET assemblies. And it's not clear to me that it's possible to assume all of the limitations necessary to make CSLA be across, work in C++, C#, and JavaScript, right? Because there's a whole, all your classes have to be sealed.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole set mm-hmm. of limitations there.
Okay.
I should say that differently. It's not clear to me that I can make those compromises without breaking backward compatibility in .NET, Silverlight, Windows Phone.
I see.
Right? And I put a high value on that. That's one of the primary value propositions in my mind for CSLA is that if you've written a WPF app over the last 4 years, 5 years, using CSLA, and now you want to go to WinRT, mm-hmm. you'll be able to take your existing business layer with virtually no change at all, recompile it for WinRT, and you'll be there.
Okay.
And not too many people can say that,
but right.
that's what CSLA does, and so that backward compatibility is a big deal. But the really important thing is that the business library that I've written, those objects, a lot of the rules, the validation and so forth, are running on the client workstation. And so for these objects to move back and forth, they have to be the same code base on
right,
the client
okay.
as the server. At present, there's no robust way to run JavaScript on the server, maybe Node.js.
Mm-hmm.
May or may not be there at this point. And honestly, and I realize this may be somewhat heretical, but not all that many people care about JavaScript and Windows 8. Of the people that I talk to, it's maybe 15 or 20% care. Most people want to do XAML and C Sharp and VB. So I don't feel a great deal of pressure yet
okay.
to support the other model.
Fair enough. We'll see what happens.
Time will tell. Like some of the recent statements about the Windows Phone only supporting the C-sharp XAML approach for WinRT are somewhat telling as well, because now if I want to reuse code between my Windows 8 machines mm-hmm. and my phone apps, I better not go with JavaScript because I won't get reuse. So I think there's some interesting dynamics around a lot of these spaces. But time will tell. So boy, there's a ton more. I mean, this, like with any framework that's been around for a while and has
right.
grown based on user feedback over, in this case, long over a decade, the types of business rules and authorization rules that you can do and the various models for constructing your data access layers are pretty robust.
This has been a really good introduction. So for people to play around with it, go get it. Right, it's free.
Yep, free.
Free.
It's an open source framework.
I love free. You've got. I know you've done a bunch of videos, but there's also samples. There's places where people can learn more about how to do this.
Yep. So if you go to latka.net, mm-hmm. My website, you can download CSLA. You can download samples. If all you want is the framework, you can get it from NuGet.
Okay.
Which is probably the easiest way. But the samples come in the download. And then I also have for purchase a whole set of ebooks, probably around 900 and some pages of, mm-hmm. of content around CSLA 4, and a set of videos for Silverlight and a set of videos for core.net. So those are all available from my website as well.
Okay, so who should use this? Anybody? Only people building particular types of apps?
This is really suited and intended for people building line of business apps.
Okay.
And even in that space, primarily applications that have some sort of either user interface or service interface.
Okay.
Which of course is most of them.
Right.
But that's important because people write batch mode apps that are
sure.
pulling huge amounts of data out of SQL Server and massaging it and putting it back in. This wouldn't work well for that.
Do I get just as much use out of it if I'm building a line of business app in just one front end? I'm just building a WPF, or I'm just building a Windows 8 app that I don't necessarily think there's ever going to be a phone version of it. I'm just building this app on one platform. Do I get as much benefit out of it?
Yes, I think you do.
Okay.
And the reason is that it gives you this consistency, repeated patterns, which reduces your cost of maintenance
mm-hmm.
and helps shield you from future changes. I mean, WinRT, for example, as excited as I am about it, it's a version 1 technology, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so over the next several years, it's bound to evolve just like Silverlight and Windows, everything else has in the past, right?
Right?
And that'll be very exciting. But it also means that something like CSLA that helps decouple you from a lot of that, I will make CSLA, let's say, 5 work with the next version of WinRT so that it
right.
minimizes the impact on people that have written business apps
yeah.
using it.
And it also gets you to adopt a particular pattern of data access, data binding, validation, which you then adopt, and then that's the way you build applications.
That's right.
Right. So if you, I mean, I find this, I build a lot of sample apps, and I guess I kind of have a style, but, you know, I wouldn't, if you said, well, what's your approach to doing validation, to doing binding, to doing these things, it's, I don't know that I have an approach. It probably kind of varies.
Right.
Right. And therefore, you wind up writing the same plumbing, writing a lot, either the same plumbing code over and over again or changing the plumbing code
that's right.
From time to time because, oh, man, last time I wrote a sample app was a year ago. I don't even remember how I did things.
Right. Yeah. And you look at your own code and you're like, what was I thinking?
Yeah.
And especially if you're looking, again, at a, any place where you've got a team of developers or a team of maintainers, that kind of consistency is so important. Especially over time.
Can you retrofit an existing app with CSLA?
You can. Definitely, I would recommend a migration approach where, because CSLA, these objects usually end up designed to support a particular user scenario or set of screen or small set of screens.
Mm-hmm.
I think you generally leave most of your app alone and rebuild one or a small set of screens to use CSLA and then slowly over time migrate. Almost never do people really do big bang, you know, greenfield approaches on these because
right.
I mean, who can afford to do that? Well, people do, but not all that often.
Okay. So, like a Windows 8 app, you know, 3 or 4 screens. It's written, and now I want to retrofit it to CSLA. That's relatively doable.
Well, so the
presumably.
The interesting thing, I think, is that every time we have a major platform shift like this one, you end up with an opportunity to do some of that big bang greenfield. I mean, people have heavy investments in Windows forms that aren't using something like CSLA. Very little of their code will go into WinRT,
mm-hmm.
right? It'll go into Windows 8 because Windows Forms runs there too.
Right.
But if they want to switch to WinRT, they're probably going to have to do major, major rework of their code. And at that point, what a great opportunity to embrace not just something like CSLA, but a UI framework and a data access framework. And you get those three frameworks so that you've got consistency in how you build your UI, how you build your business logic, and how you do your data access.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that just sets you up for success going forward.
Right. Cool.
So.
Awesome.
Great. Well, thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for coming on. Hope you guys found this useful. If you're interested in particularly this framework or frameworks in general, highly recommend that you look at this one. Go to Rocky's site, download it, play around with it. Let them know what you think. And see you next time on Visual Studio Toolbox.